Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 12th of July, 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, Mike Robinson. Can I say how nice it is to be back, Mike?
Is it?
Of course. Absolutely.
Good stuff.
Okay. Well, we're delighted we'll be joined by Patrick Henningsen from 21st Century Wire today. And some very interesting things going on in the news and indeed worldwide, but we better start with the most important news, apparently. And this young lady, Ariana Grande, if I've pronounced that correctly,
I have no idea,
has been made an honorary citizen of Manchester. So The Guardian reporting, the BBC, this is apparently major news and very important.
Good stuff.
And do you know why she's getting an honorary citizenship of Manchester?
It must be related to holding a special concert or something.
Yes, apparently she decided it was a good idea to hold a special concert, and so her team obviously put that concert together for her, and she's been rewarded, and this is major news. And if you feel a hint of sarcasm, it's certainly there. Contrast that with this other piece of major news from the Telegraph, and reporter in this case is suggesting that it would be a great shame if our great institutions were pulled down in the hunt for sex abusers. So what I read into this is, well, we mustn't probe too deeply if they're great institutions, say the legal institution, for example, or the police or Westminster. It would be completely wrong if a thorough investigation meant that we had to dismantle those institutions.
That would be really sad.
That would be really sad. So have a read of that article in the Telegraph. And of course, we can also take a look. It's based on the story about a bishop called Ball, who had carried out a few indiscretions. But the church is really saying, well, these things happen, we should move on. So the church being one of the great institutions, I can see that there's a willingness to sort of gently push that one under the carpet as well.
Okay.
So there we are. That's the news.
Excellent. Well, okay, if that's the news, there's lots going on at an international level, at least. So yesterday, Sergei Lavrov and Federica Mogherini were meeting. This was a great meeting. They were in Brussels, of course, and Federica Mogherini is the EU foreign minister, effectively. So they were shaking hands there, looking as if they're very happy to be together. Although they are shaking hands, this was before they spoke to each other. And in the press conference afterwards, they were clearly not getting along quite so well with Ms. Mogherini, admitting they do not share the same positions on everything. So there you go. Now, Sergei Lavrov then was pretty annoyed, really, with various things. He said it was high time that the European Union looked at the consequences of sanctions imposed by both themselves and the United States against Syria, because the sanctions hamper humanitarian efforts. And he said the situation is outrageous. It seems that the time has come, and I think it has come a long time ago, to see the humanitarian consequences of those sanctions that the EU and the United States have imposed against Syria. Mogherini didn't really agree with him. This is what she had to say. None of our sanctions on Syria affect the civilian population. They're all targeted at individuals that hold specific responsibility in the war. We're not a military player in Syria. We decided not to be. And if I can add that we're even proud of not being one, but what we can do and what we are doing day by day is using the support we can give politically, but also financially, to the political process based on military agreements. The European Union is ready to come in with all its strength, financial, political, organisational, diplomatic and so on, to support going back to normal life inside Syria, because building peace requires a ceasefire, but then requires also building the living conditions of communities. And here is where the European Union will bring its power of peace. So what do you make of that?
Well, I'm sat here, my almost lost for words, of course, because if we look at what's been done in Syria, as in many Middle Eastern countries, the West has got involved and ripped them to pieces. And she's saying, well, we haven't really done anything to affect the Syrian population. We're only targeting individuals. We've seen those pictures of utter devastation of Syria. similar to the pictures of Dresden from my recollections of some of those Second World War photographs. The truth has gone out of the window with the European Union now. They're running on rails. They're running their agenda. Truth, facts, evidence don't apply, aren't needed. We're just carrying on with what we think our policy is.
Lavrov was particularly incensed about the fact that sanctions are causing medical assistance to be unavailable in Syria. And so for her to suggest that civilians don't suffer the consequences of this is utterly ridiculous. Anyway, that was yesterday. Today, then, another day, another Ukrainian summit, it seems. So we had three Ukrainian summits or conferences last week in the UK. And then we had the NATO-Ukraine conference that we reported on yesterday. Today, we now have the EU-Ukraine summit. It's today and tomorrow. And this is in Kiev. Donald Tusk and Jean-Claude Juncker, representing the European Council and European Commission, two of the European presidents, will hand President Poroshenko of Ukraine a letter notifying Ukraine that the European Union has completed ratification of a political and trade pact. And this treaty is aiming to align Ukraine's economy with the single market. The EU ratification, which was completed yesterday, comes on the back of a visa waiver, which was put in place last week so that Ukrainians can visit Europe. And Poroshenko is also looking to start talks with NATO on membership plans. We mentioned that yesterday. So this conference, the leaders are going to focus on the importance of pursuing an ambitious reform process, especially in the fight against corruption and the conflict in eastern Ukraine and Russia's illegal annexation of Crimea and Sevastopol. I think Patrick covered that yesterday in reasonable detail already. So apparently Russia has now illegally annexed Sevastopol, despite the fact it's been there for a few hundred years. And then they also want to discuss the implementation of the Minsk agreements. And they also want to look at ways to maximize the benefits and potential of the EU-Ukraine Association Agreement. Brian, what this looks to me very much like is preparations for full EU membership in Ukraine, particularly the comments regarding, aligning Ukraine's economy with the single market.
Well, this is drawing Ukraine into the EU organisation. At the same time, we've got the EU military unification going on, which Britain is fully part of. So we've got Brexit talks, apparently. Brexit is still the big lie being spun, but behind the scenes, Britain is taking full part in the annexation of Eastern European states. Absolutely. Is how I see it.
Absolutely. Which brings us nicely onto this, because here's another summit which is going on today. This is the Trieste summit on the Western Balkans. And in fact, Boris is in Trieste today to continue to help, he says, the Western Balkans reform, stabilise, prosper. So I wasn't clear, Brian, when I read that in the press release, whether he meant reform or reform. And we might get a clue as to which of those two pronunciations is actually relevant here. So Federica Mogherini is going to be there, as you would expect, because she's the High Representative for the European Union for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy, and various other people from Austria, Croatia, France, Germany, Italy, Slovenia, and the UK are going to be there. They're going to discuss the issues which were outlined on a joint statement made on the 16th of March, including laying foundations for a common Balkan market, or rather a Balkan common market, increased regional cooperation, improving and expanding infrastructure and energy services, curbing migration, and fighting corruption, terrorism, and radicalism. They're going to talk about rebuilding war-torn areas in the region, they're calling this the Balkan Marshall Plan. How long ago was the Balkan War? 1990s, right? The Balkan Marshall Plan, they're still talking about rebuilding it. What does this mean for Iraq, Syria, Libya?
Well, my take on this is they need the instability everywhere to keep people's eye off the main bit that they're doing, which is building this EU superstate piece by piece. What comes into my mind is a paper called The EU's Hidden Hand. If my memory serves me correctly, this appeared about the mid-late 90s. I do not have a copy of it anymore, but I can remember reading it. I think it was found by one of the UKIP members in the European Parliament. And what the EU was saying is that whereas a major power like America used military power in order to expand and push its overseas objectives, Europe did it under the surface by means of political manoeuvring. Mm. And I think this is exactly what we're starting to see.
Boris is delighted because he's announced that next year's Western Balkans summit will take place in the United Kingdom. But let's have a look at what else he said. We want to see the Western Balkans as a stable, secure, prosperous region succeeding in Europe. The UK is unfailingly committed to working together with our friends and allies to make the Western Balkans a beacon of democracy and economic growth. So that's it, really. But I think, you know, what we're talking about here, Brian, is reform, not reform, because they're talking about creating a common market, which is really the first step towards creating a sort of mini European Union there.
Yeah. And then they will be working on the rest of the institutions. So they'll be into banking, they'll be into the police, they'll be into civil society to try and get it into mirror image of the EU as it is in a central form.
Let's bring Patrick in at this point. Welcome to the programme. Patrick, what are your thoughts on this?
I think it's worth pointing out that the Balkans actually not so long ago had a democratic, federalized, and economic union. It was called Yugoslavia, actually, and existed quite successfully for a very long time until it was smashed to pieces by NATO. And by Britain and the United States, primarily.
Indeed. So there we go. Everything comes around full circle, I guess. Let's have a look at a little piece of video. Now, I'm going to interrupt this as we go, Brian, and we'll sort of make comments on it as we go. But this was apparently produced by the counterterrorism division of, I guess, the Met Police.
In fact, it would be the Association of Chief Police Officers, now the National Police Chiefs Council.
Ah, right. Okay, so let's have a look at this then.
Firearms and weapons attacks are thankfully rare. However, in the unlikely event of an attack, being prepared and knowing how to respond is important and may save lives.
So, Brian, this was supposed to be an anti-terrorism thing, but firearms seems to be the main...
Firearms and weapons attacks.
But no mention of bomb attacks?
No. It's a very interesting video. We've watched it several times. We think there's a very different message from the one the government is trying to put across here. But no, it's anti-terrorism, but we're talking about weapons and weapons attacks.
Well, let's continue.
So this film will give you simple and straightforward advice on what to do if an attack occurs. It's an opportunity to plan your response, minimize the risk, and stay safe. If you hear gunshots, think about your safest option and insist others go with you. Don't let their indecision slow you down.
Please go. Leave the building immediately.
Once you identify a safe route, run. Make sure your route doesn't put you in the line of fire.
So we've got to make sure nobody gets left behind, but if they're prepared to stay behind, we've just got to run and leave them.
But I find this extraordinary, Mike. We are saying that there's an event happening, you're telling people to run. In any other event where there's a risk to people, you're normally saying, stay calm, assess the situation, walk, don't run. But in this case, all of a sudden, you're saying to people, you've got to run. What happens if you've got an elderly parent with you on holiday? Maybe you've got a disabled person or a disabled child. They're not going to run, but you're going to run. I think this video is designed to instill fear in people. And I think it's designed, the whole video is put together in a way that's pushing fear. And it's leading to confusion, because if a family goes on holiday, some of those family members are not going to be able to run very fast. But they're saying, try and encourage them to go. But if they don't want to go, you've got to go. Leave them.
Okay.
avoid dead ends and bottlenecks. If you can't move to safety, then hide. When the police arrive, they will be armed. They will deal with the immediate threat first to prevent further casualties. This could take some time. The police may be unable to distinguish between you and an attacker.
Oh, police! Stand up!
They may treat you firmly. Do everything they tell you to. Don't make any sudden movements or gestures that could be seen as a threat. Stay calm. Don't shout or wave, and keep your hands visible so they can see that you're unarmed.
One of them went.
So the other additional piece of fear we've got coming in here is you're going to be fearful of the police. Because they don't know whether you're terrorist or not. So you need to be frightened because the police effectively could shoot you. They're going to make a mistake. So that's fear ramped in, fear of all those things. I think this is a despicable video. And we're going to have a look at some of the analysis of what the government itself has said about the terrorist threat. But the whole of that video clip, the movement, the flicking between images, the pace, the music, it's like something from a nasty little psychological thriller. Patrick.
Well, just before we bring Patrick on, I just want to mention this, because in RT last night, they were discussing this, and they had this gentleman on here, Major Chris Hunter, and he said, we have a choice to either give up some of our civil liberties or to live with terrorism day to day and continue to die. And it was quite a despicable position to take, wasn't it?
I don't know what sort of level of analysis that is by this so-called counterterrorism expert. And I think that's kind of that says a lot about where society is when you have someone who puts themselves out as a major expert or figure, and that's the message they're putting him out, which is that you have to give up your liberties, give up your rights, or die, basically, is what he's putting out there. So it's kind of, I don't know, I don't want to say anything really bad about this person, about what they said, but it just flies in the face of so many of the fundamental things that are the real values, the really important things that underpin a free society. He is just railed against right there.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, let's have a look at the quote from this gentleman. It's Lord Ahmed, and he's had this to say. While there is no specific information that British holidaymakers will be targeted this summer, it sets out some simple steps we can all take to minimise the impact of an attack if one does take place. So there's no specific information, this man says, but everybody should watch this video. And then I can just imagine a little conversation, a couple are going on holiday with their children, and maybe the wife is going to be saying to her husband, have you planned the necessary steps in case there's a terrorist threat? Mm. So we don't see a specific threat, but you all need to watch a nasty little video, which is going to start people fearful, not of a bomb going off, but of some form of weapons attack. And when you're frightened enough about that, then you're going to be doubly frightened because the police who come to supposedly protect you are actually capable of shooting you if they make the wrong decision.
Yeah.
This is a brilliant message. So I'm just going to add this bit on the corner of this one. There's no specific terror information, but what this man is doing along with the others is ramping up the fear factor. So we thought we'd have a look at where this lot comes from. And here we are into the National Police Chiefs Council. This is the new body which took over from the Association of Chief Police Officers, which, of course, was a private company. I believe this is also a private company, or parts of it are private company. I couldn't find it in the time I had available before the news. I find it interesting that this organisation says that it is heading up counter-terrorism in this country, working in a network with other agencies. So could it be that we have a private company that is now apparently heading counter-terrorism? Mm. Could that be the case? Well, if you follow through on the documents, you're going to come up against this one, CONTEST, the United Kingdom's strategy for countering terrorism. And a lot of words in the document itself. So we're saying that there's been a significant and changing threat from Daesh. And in 2015, there were almost 60 attacks from Paris to Sydney. It mentions Al-Qaeda, which is interesting because in all the rest of the reports, Al-Qaeda has disappeared. But it says the UK government counter-terrorism strategy contest has the power to be successful, has proven to be successful over a number of years. My response to that is we never see evidence which proves that these things have been successful. We're told that all these terrorist incidents have been prevented, but we never actually see any evidence whatsoever that there was a threat or that one was successfully stopped. So where's this little document come from? Well, we better bring in this. This is just the final page of that opening paragraph. And of course, it's signed by Amber Rudd. And it's reassuring to know that she's got her finger on the pulse as far as counterterrorism is concerned.
Absolutely.
So let's remember, we've come in through the National Police Chiefs Council. We've got documentation like contest. I recommend you have a read of this document to see the government congratulating itself on stopping terrorist threats. We've never had any proof that they existed in the first place. So we're bringing a bit more of it here. And this bit is quite interesting because, I've just called it in. There we are. It says the threat from terrorism in 2015, there were 11,774 recorded terrorist attacks in 92 countries, a decrease of 13% compared with the 2014 total. I don't remember anybody over the last couple of years, Mike, talking about a decrease in terrorist attacks. We've constantly been told that they've been increasing.
Yeah.
And if there was this decrease, it would be nice to have some analysis as to why the threat had gone down, because presumably we could learn some lessons in driving it down further. But that doesn't take place in this document, because this is casually mentioned, but the rest of the document is, of course, how the threat has increased. So I'll leave our viewers and listeners to have a think about that. If we come back to the council itself, what have they got to say? It says that recorded crime levels have decreased over the last 5 years, but new and emerging crime types have led to a shift in demand for policing that presents challenging to police forces. And it goes on to say that they've published a plan at the start of 2016-17 designed to support the draft Policing Vision 2020. And if you work your way through that, what it's talking about is embedding the police into communities and societies, and the police working in a network with the College of Policing, Association of Police and Crime Commissioners, Home Office, MI5, National Crime Agency, to ensure a coordinated national response. So what I detect from this, Mike, is that basically they are planning that the police are not a separate body who police by consent. The police are going to be integrated with local authorities, mental health services, MI5, counter-terrorism, and they're actually going to be embedded in the community. And the inference I pick up is that we're not to know who is going to be police, who's spying, who's reporting for the police. But trust us, because these are the people protecting us from terrorism.
Yeah.
So I thought a diagram was necessary. Let's have a look at how it pans out. So top of the tree, MPCC. We've got the National Counterterrorism Policing Headquarters under their authority. Then we've got the National Counterterrorism Policing Network. We've got the Counterterrorism Policing Operations, 11 regional counterterrorism units. And of course, they've got a policy that we've just had a little look through. Now, let's bring in the link through to MI5, because all of this is being done with a friendly collaboration with MI5 and the Director General here, Andrew Parker. This is an interesting little quote from Detective Chief Superintendent Scott Wilson from the National Coordinator Protect and Prepare strategy. He says, as we've seen in Tunisia in 2015, any Westerner is likely to be a target anywhere in the world. Any Westerner, Mike, any of us, anywhere in the world. But surprisingly, Lord Ahmed said that there weren't any specific threats.
Right.
So this is the theme. You hear the rhetoric, the BBC picking up, the mainstream media. When you dig into the detail, it's contradictory. There's no evidence to back up all of this fear. He goes on to say here, we've seen attacks in numerous countries, so we're trying to say Western tourists overseas should be aware of what they should and shouldn't do if they're caught up in such an attack. So there isn't a threat, but we're going to tell people there is a threat and they've got to prepare for it in order to make themselves fearful. Well, not to worry, because we've got some expertise from Coca-Cola. So we've got this gentleman, Deep Sagar, who is the chair of MPCC Audit and Assurance. So he's got a key role in making sure that MPCC is doing the right counter-terrorism policy. What's his credential for doing that? Well, he was formerly a Coca-Cola executive.
Good stuff.
Are you feeling happier? I wasn't. I had a little more, spent a little bit more time looking at this gentleman, and I found a list of all his public appointments. Now, some of these are current, some of them aren't. Difficult for me to read because the list is so long. Let's see whether we can do that. Bear with me. So we've got Ashbridge School, Barnet Homes, Casino Advisory Panel, Community Scotland, Councillors Remuneration Panel, Northern Ireland. It goes on. Flood Risk Management Wales, Glasgow Employers Coalition, Inspectorate of Education, Information Standards Board, Public Guardian. How can anybody do all of these jobs, Mike? How has one man got the experience to do these roles?
We have come across these types of characters before, haven't we, where they seem to have superhuman powers.
Superhuman powers. Well, it goes on. We've got here Thurrock Thames Gateway Development Corporation, Trustmark, Turnstone Support, Wales Audit Office Shadow Board, Welsh Government Sector Panel, and your choice. So if you're thinking this is really quite amazing, let's bring in this one, which I found interesting. So he's also a board member of CAFCAS. So this man is also caring about children and the position of children in court. So have we got a conflict of interest with this man? That's one question. What is the experience of this man to effectively be a lead figure in the UK's counter-terrorism policy? We've no idea.
Yes. Okay. Well, let's move across the pond then. And Patrick, we'll just talk about the latest scandal, which is not a scandal at all, it seems. So Donald Trump Jr. has published some emails, and he made a statement about it before he published them. He said to everyone, in order to be totally transparent, I'm releasing the entire email chain of my emails with Rob about the meeting on the 9th of June 2016. The first email is June the 3rd, 2016, was from Rob, was relating to a request from Emin, a person I knew from 2013, from the 2013 Miss Universe pageant near Moscow. Emin and his father have a very highly respected, or so they are very highly respected in Moscow. They suggested they had information about Hillary Clinton, I thought was political opposition research. I first wanted to just have a phone call, but when that didn't cut it, they said the woman would be in New York and asked if I would meet. I decided to take the meeting. The woman, as she has said publicly, was not a government official. And as we've said, she had no information to provide and wanted to talk about the adoption policy and the Magnitsky Act. To put this in context, this was before the current Russian fever was in vogue. And as said just today in the press, the entire meeting was the most inane nonsense I ever heard. And I was actually agitated by it. So apparently Paul Manafort, and Jared Kushner met for 20 minutes with this person, and they met with a Russian lawyer who, it was claimed, would offer damning information on Hillary Clinton's illicit Russian contacts. but that doesn't seem to have actually taken place. So, Patrick, just run us through who the key players are in this.
Okay, so the key player, obviously, is Donald Trump Jr., and this was before Russia Mania took over U.S. politics last summer. So one of his friends, former associate of the Trump Organization, or current associate, Rob Goldstone, I believe is an agent or a manager for an Azerbaijani singer, pop singer, something obscure like this. And so he was going to introduce Trump and Jared Kushner and Paul Manafort, newly appointed campaign manager, to a Russian lawyer. And it's, what's interesting as well, CNN reported as a Russian government lawyer. It's still up on CNN's website right now, which is factually incorrect. So more fake news from CNN. So this amounted to nothing. No information was handed over. So there's no story here. But this is blown up in the U.S. media. I mean, it seems like at any opportunity, the left media in America think that impeachment for Trump is on the horizon. It could come any moment now. They've got people wound up in such a state that they actually believe all of this stuff. But there's absolutely, I don't think there's anything here. I think this is just the latest desperate attempt to somehow validate one of the biggest hoaxes in modern politics, which is Russiagate. But if you look at the timing of this story, it's very interesting because this comes at a time when there is now renewed pressure to renew sanctions against Russia. This is very important. And not only that, this move to approach the Ukraine in a more formal fashion. So these things go hand in hand. So anything to demonize the president and maybe undermine the progress that was made at the G20 in Hamburg just this past week. Certainly this story looks like it was placed for that. This could have been a setup for all we can see. It looks like a classic setup. Go ahead.
Yeah, Patrick, even if this were true, which I think we're all in agreement it isn't, but even if it were true, at least the narrative were true, is there any law in the U.S. Which references collusion or so-called collusion with foreign governments?
No, there's not. The only thing that's remotely close might be like the Logan Act, which I don't think anyone's ever been prosecuted. So you can't meet people in government, serving in government, cannot go and meet and negotiate any sort of business with other countries or other entities on government time, basically. So everyone at Bilderberg would be guilty of this, by the way. Any public officials, but it's never been prosecuted. Donald Trump Jr. is a private citizen helping with his father's presidential campaign. So there's nothing there in terms of treason. No information was passed anyway. It's just a ridiculous talking point. It's amazing that they're actually that desperate to go for a word like that in this case.
Oh, okay. So if no law has been broken by Trump and his family and colleagues, there's some law has been broken here, because where did the emails come from in the first place? I mean, these emails were, he has released the full email chain because, what was it, the New York Times claimed that they were about to publish?
That's right. And Julian Assange from WikiLeaks heard this and encouraged Donald Trump Jr. to preempt the New York Times by releasing the email chain himself, which I think he did. Which I think was an excellent move. He could have done what Hillary did and just delete all of the emails, of course. So I think that was good that he did put them out and show a little bit of transparency. Certainly Hillary Clinton would have benefited from that, or maybe not, because we still haven't found all those emails from Hillary. But in terms of collusion, the Clinton campaign actually colluded with foreign governments to undermine the Trump campaign. And not only that, the Clinton campaign, Philip Brains, one of her campaign workers, colluded with CNN's foreign correspondent head, Elise Labo. And they coordinated on Twitter on how to tweet in order to undermine and to defame Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky. This was this was the summer before the election cycle kicked into primaries gear. So at that time, Rand Paul was seen as potential competition for Hillary Clinton. And so she was very keen to knock him out and damage him on the Republican trail at the time. So I thought that was interesting.
And of course, one of the governments that the Hillary Clinton campaign colluded with was, in fact, well, at least British assets, whether they're actually ex-MI6 or not, they still were.
Yeah, and they paid large sums of money to create a dossier that turned out to be a complete fake, full of garbage information. This was put together by Fusion GPS, this firm that was paid large sums of money to put together with a bogus document, which was signed off by this man, Christopher Steele, ex-British intelligence agent, so forth. And so not only that, but the government of the Ukraine, the Clinton campaign, the DNC, and Yahoo News and other members of the press colluded directly with the Ukrainian embassy, with members of the Ukrainian state at the time, and to undermine and to sort of damage the Trump campaign. That's the story, actually. But that is not being picked up or reported by any of these media outlets. The Washington Post, they're all having a meal out of this non-story. So it's, you know, they've already chosen their target. So that's where the media is at right now. You can't depend on them to do an honest job.
Okay, so the emails were hacked in the first place. Now, Pat Lang believes that Susan Rice, John Brennan, and James Comey might be good targets for prosecution. Is that a reasonable list?
Yeah, you could say so. Yeah, hacking would be definitely illegal. He's not a public figure. He's not a public office holder. He's not running for office. So he's a private citizen. Someone's hacked the emails, stolen the emails, and then put them out. So I think this thing was a setup from the beginning. I think it was a setup and the hack, and everything is connected. I think this was meant to be some sort of scandal. This is what they're really in the cul-de-sac, the bottom of the bag now. There's not much left with the Russia thing. So they're just basically clearing out all the potential scandals that they have lined up. And this is one of the last ones, probably.
Well, I mean, you mentioned CNN already. So here's just a couple of the typical headlines from them this morning. Pro-Trump media scrambles to react to bombshell emails. The six most troubling parts of Don Jr.'s email exchange with Rob Goldstone. CNN... It can't survive this, can it?
No, but this is the level of coverage you got in America right now. This is they've been doing this for 8 or 9 months, 10 months maybe, and it's just they're just recycling nothing over and over again, and their credibility is just falling lower and lower. They seem to, instead of just kind of cleaning house and cleaning up their organization, start doing actual news reporting and actual analysis. They're still hurt about the Clinton defeat. And they still believe the media establishment and the liberal progressive establishment still believe in their resistance, what they call resistance, relentless resistance, they call it, that they'll somehow bring this president down. It's just a question of just, you know, are they trying hard enough? So that's what we're seeing.
Okay, thank you for that, Patrick. Let's move on. Brian.
Okay, well, let's bring in this, which is the BBC now doing an analysis, piecing together the timeline of London's Grenfell Tower fire in the words of victims and survivors. This is a very, very interesting piece of journalism for all sorts of reasons. If we just take a peek into the first part of it, it's basically saying that it's giving a timeline of what took place. It talks about the fridge fire and the fire spreading. But when we get down to the bottom of this, it says this particular sentence, every person's recollection of a traumatic event is unique. A memory can sometimes be unreliable. But what follows are insights into what people in Grenfell Tower faced that night. So what is the BBC up to here, Mike? To me, I read through this. There's a lot of detail. There's a lot of very glossy figures. This is the BBC creating a story of what happened in people's minds. It uses, it says, the recollection of people who were actually there, but it then undermines them by saying, well, of course, you're saying this, but memory can be unreliable. It then puts the whole thing together as if it's all factual. And this is a very clever piece of text, but so, I don't know what the real purpose is. I feel uneasy about it.
Well, it seems to me, and you can correct me if you think I'm wrong, it seems to me that what the BBC is saying here is, well, the local people's recollections may be unreliable, but we, the BBC, are pulling together the strands of everything, and we will provide the definitive narrative on what happened.
Yeah. It says that it's slow. Everything that's happening is slow. It says that they haven't finalized the number of victims yet. They mention this figure of 80 again. They talk about the number of people who survived. But there's no in-depth analysis. There's no key question. How many people were there in the building at the time that the fire took place? This is the key question. And we could start approaching it by saying, what was a normal occupancy level? Would the occupancy on the night of the fire have been up or down on what was a general average? Nobody wants to mention this. They drift around what the supposed number of casualties are, is. And basically the BBC here now producing a narrative, which I think they're doing this to try and fix it in people's minds, but it's not based on factual information. Mm-hmm. Now, who's put this together? Well, this is the lady, Georgina Ranard. And what do we know about her? Not a lot. She's a journalist. She's a Google News Fellow. Is that a plus point? I don't know. But so I did pick up this one on her Twitter page because it says, after nearly 3 weeks researching and interviewing the victims of Grenfell Tower, here are the people we know about. And then underneath it says, who were the victims? BBC News, names and backgrounds of the victims of the Grenfell Tower. So there's a bit of ambiguity there, because in talking about victims, she's obviously not talking about people who've died in the fire. It's confusing. But are we really saying that none of the formal government agencies are putting together the picture of what has happened? It's this BBC Google journalist who's apparently putting the narrative together, which an inquiry will then follow. Mm. Or am I being cynical?
No, I don't think you are. It still staggers me that okay, the police came out, as we mentioned on yesterday's programme, came out a couple of days ago and said that 255 people had escaped, and they said that their investigations led them to believe that 350 people were in the building. But that is still not a definitive figure. It's an assessment, a judgment, a guess.
And it goes against what local people are saying, because local people are saying that the building was full.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So so the BBC and mainstream media, still, as we mentioned on yesterday's programme, not challenging why there is not a proper official figure, a proper government position on what the situation was.
But good to know that we've got Coca-Cola and Google running serious parts of the country at the moment.
Right. We'll just end on this one. Just briefly, it is a Spectator. You know, Boris Johnson used to work there. So, you know, you take it with a pinch of salt, perhaps. But this article here from Brendan O'Neill, the headline is, "If Brexit doesn't happen, then Britain isn't a democracy." And he says, "It's the casualness with which they're saying it that is truly disturbing. I'm beginning to think that Brexit may never happen," said Vince Cable on Sunday morning television with expert nonchalance, as if he was predicting rain. He echoed Newsnight's Nicholas Watt, who a few days earlier informed viewers that there is talk in some quarters that Brexit may not actually happen. "Leaving the EU, I think that is very much open to question now," said Lord Heseltine last month with imperious indifference. So my point here, the reason for highlighting this article, is that he is quite rightly pointing out that more and more of the pro-European commentators within the political establishment and MPs are now really drifting out this idea that Brexit isn't going to happen. Yeah. And he ends up by saying, he says, "We have to get real. If Brexit doesn't happen, democracy will be gravely wounded for a generation. The people have received loud and clear messages. The people will receive loud and clear the message that they don't really matter. Sure, we still have the general elections and pick our MPs, but the Brexit betrayal would rankle us for decades. A sore on the body politic, a niggling reminder that when democracy returned, a result that the political class didn't like, Britain flinched and turned its back on democracy. Brexit must happen. It simply must, because 17.4 million people want it and democracy needs it." Now, I would make the point that, of course, that's exactly what happened in 2003 when people came out in the streets over the Iraq War. So there's nothing terribly new in government ignoring the wishes of people.
Yeah.
Democracy has been dead in this country for a long time, Brian.
Dead for a long time, but we're now starting to really understand the criminal cabal that's running the country. And of course, that criminal cabal not only prepared to help fund and stoke up the wars and the violence overseas, they're prepared to lie to the British people about what they are doing behind closed doors. And we've now got to the very dangerous stage where the government is running its own behavioural insights team to use applied psychology to change the way we view their actions. Pretty dangerous stuff. We'll end there. Patrick, thank you very much for joining us. We will be back at the same time tomorrow. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.